Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Robin Raskin, ICT and CES legend and digital pioneer. Robin, oh man, you have this amazing background. You've done everything, and you're famous for all the things that you've done over the past years. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you. Famous or infamous, we'll figure that out, but thank you.
Now, Robin, you've done a lot and just amazing profile that you have. So can you explain why your top four roles have impacted the world?
Yeah, it looks a little eclectic, but it really all leads to the same path. And believe it or not, it started when I married an engineer and didn't understand anything he was saying, but knew that working on computers was going to be huge and transform the world. Just knew it in my gut. But I was an English major, so my first job was at PC Magazine, where I had a number of jobs but went on to be the editor of the magazine. And it was right at the beginning of the PC revolution, a PC on every desktop, were Bill Gates's words, and we were taught to look for benchmarks and how to look at the performance of machines and differentiate one from another. And it was fantastic training. We had a huge lab, lots of money put towards research, but it started to occur to me that there was more going on here than just microscopic benchmarks. Like, after a while, how quickly you could open Adobe Photoshop on your PC became meaningless. And so I wanted to look at a broader picture, and I saw what was happening in the family market. And I saw a generation of families buying their first PCs for their kids. And I said, I'm going to launch a magazine called Family PC, and it's going to tell families how to grow up in the digital age. It was a joint venture between Disney Publishing and Ziff Davis Publishing, entertainment and high tech. And I knew I was onto something. It was fantastic. We had real families testing things. Needless to say, print magazines got a little beat up, and I went to Yahoo for a while, where I started their tech lifestyles area, and then decided that actually during that time I've done television, I've written books. I'd like to say that I've never met a media I didn't like, and I think that one of the skills I have is understanding all media and the difference. So finally, I 6 years ago started a conferences company that would look at what it means to be digital in this world based on your lifestyle. And so I have a show, various conferences and exhibits taking you from being a kids at play for kids. I have a mommy tech conference. I have a boomer conference, digital health, sports and fitness, higher ed tech. So basically looking at all of those transition areas in life when your technology needs get different and how is the industry meeting them. And so I bring together the people I've met throughout my life into these new situations where they can cross-pollinate and share ideas.
You know, it's interesting. I've been in the ICT industry since the 1960s. And I do remember fondly some of those publications like PC Magazine, but little would I know that I'd be talking to the editor. So it's kind of an amazing journey.
It was an amazing, PC Magazine was an amazing journey. And I credit Bill Ziff from Ziff Davis, who had the idea that technology was going to be as much a sport as his other publications, aviation and photography, and that people were going to just embrace this. And he called it right, and then Bill McCrone, our editor-in-chief, who came up with the idea of the editor's choice done with quantitative and qualitative serious research. So it was kind of just fabulous. I mean, people were building their own computers. People were walking in off the street saying, I just built this motherboard. Could you test it? And we've come a long way very quickly.
I can imagine your Rolodex, though, must be amazing because you followed the whole history of evolution of this entire industry, so you would know all the principles and the pioneers, like yourself, who was also a pioneer in this industry.
Yeah, but you know, my job is to be the storyteller for them. The industry's gotten better at it, but for a while, being a technologist and being the rest of the world, there was a big difference. And I really, in the very first thing I ever wrote, I wrote a piece called How I Learned About Computers to Save Our Marriage. And it was the story of my husband bringing home a Unix terminal for me to learn NROTH, TROTH, and VI, and he wanted me to throw away my typewriter. And I said, what, are you kidding me? This is really hard. But on the other hand, I could see that someday women will be able to work at home. People will be able to discuss ideas. So I said, it's not like another hobby like baseball or golf or pool. I am definitely on the program, and I encourage other women to jump on the program too. InfoWorld bought that for $25, and I really never looked back again. They printed that letter that I wrote as sort of a plea to for people to embrace technology.
You know, when I was at CES in January in Las Vegas, I was talking to one of the delegates there, and he was saying, you know, Robin's actually probably responsible for 40% of the content here and all the amazing stuff that occurs. So I'm thinking, you know, I attended the mobile and the gadgets events, and you know what? They were great. So can you describe these in more detail and the outstanding products?
Yes. So my philosophy in sharing the fruits of technology is to make it entertaining and informative at the same time, that really people remember more. What do you remember going to school? Do you remember the most entertaining moments? Probably happened on television and not in school, but so I wanted to create an atmosphere that would celebrate the diversity and breadth of technology and give people a good time. So I started with The Last Gadget Standing, and the premise was really simple. Journalists are out there, they're looking for the next greatest thing, they're telling you about all the bells and whistles, but half of what they say doesn't never, actually there are 20,000 products launched at CES each year, and I would venture to say, I don't know the exact number, that 40% of them never make it off that show floor. And so I wanted to show that the people know best. And so The Last Gadget Standing is a contest where people vote both online and in a real live audience experience. And through a bunch of selections, we keep winnowing the list of contenders down until there are 10 finalists who each get 4 minutes to present their case for why their technology is transformative in this particular year. And I got to tell you, I've been doing it for 13 years. I did without the online component before online, and it works. People have really good sensibility. This year was a little different because we had Kickstarter, and I had to make a decision about whether to allow very young companies that weren't particularly well-funded or might never get funded. And so the world has changed, and I've had to accommodate it as it goes along and made decisions that it had to be a working prototype that was really about to go into manufacturing, that it couldn't just be a cocktail napkin that you handed me to be in this. And so it was each year it gets more interesting and more diverse. And just to give you an idea, this year's winners were one very large company, Lenovo, who came in with a 40-inch tabletop, Windows 8, multi-screen, multi-touch. It sort of looks like you're playing ping pong, game-playing machine, and a keyboard called Translucence that lets you customize templates. Let's say you're working with Photoshop and you want one keyboard, or you're working with Word and you want another keyboard. And it's also, touch and swipe sensitive. It's got colors built in. It glows very softly. It's transparent, beautiful design. But you can customize it for the way you need to use a keyboard at a specific instance. And they actually were a younger company, really small, and they've now grown. They just increased office space, hired more people. So we think that not only is it fun and entertaining for people, but it actually produces business results.
I was just amazed at that MyScript application at the mobile app event, and I guess Apple has been featuring it too, so I thought it was just amazing.
So MyScript calculator, and this has never happened before in the mobile app showdown. We normally get a company that wins online and a company that wins in real life. But my script calculator was so mind-blowing that they won both the online and the live award, which is the first time that's ever happened. And what they do, if you can picture this, you take your finger and you write on your iPad or your phone an equation. And it can be trigonometric, it can have cosines, it can solve, it can have constants. Write with your finger, it turns it into digital text and solves the equation. And it's just the most amazing thing that you've ever seen. Math teachers everywhere will get upset because kids will never have to solve these things again. But it's a fabulous technology. The same company also has a MyScript note taker so you can hand write and have it turn to digital text. But I think the math really got people excited.
I talked about the fact because of your great history, and again, this really amazing history as one of the foremost pioneers in the industry, your Rolodex must be amazing. And I know you had Vint Cerf, you know, who, for the audience sake, by the way, is considered an inventor of the Internet. Well, he was a keynote. So can you describe that and how you got him there and what were the top takeaways from that session?
Yeah, so Vint Cerf, yes, was one of the people responsible for the TCP protocol and has been not just a visionary about the Internet, but a visionary about human nature and government, and also represented to me the boomer audience. You know, as the numbers of older people in this country grow, the issues technology will have to solve change. And so we invited Vint to address people who and show them that, for one thing, baby boomers invented the Internet and weren't done inventing it yet. For two, he's been really outspoken about the regulatory climate and very eloquent in that the Internet must, you know, remain free and access granted, and really has a vision of the future, which I guess the name is the Internet of Things, where everything has an IP address. So everything will be IP driven, from your car to your shower to your coffee pot. So you're coming home from work and you want to turn on your oven, well, you just take your mobile phone and get dinner started. And that as we shift away from other things to IP driven things, things are going to be kind of amazing. And I think that was what he really wanted to talk about, was keeping the Internet free, keeping competition going, and making sure that this Internet of Things will come to fruition.
Now, Robin, everybody knows you are the heart of CES, the foundation for CES in so many ways. So can we drill into the numbers? Like, what were the most notable areas?
Well, you know, so every year, this is why I love going to CES. I call it like the China Silk Road. You know, people march up and down the Silk Road all year, but then you get to the bazaar, and when it really is bizarre in both senses of the word, but technology flourishes because different parties come together. And there's usually a theme every year, and I would say this year the breakthrough technology that we saw was the 4K TVs, which have double the resolution of existing TVs, more pixels, and they will, they're about $20,000 a set right now, and they are so lifelike that it's frightening, it begs all that question that we talk about: how much resolution do you really need to have a viewing experience? But in the business side, for robotics, for hospitals, for doctors, for so many people who need this increased resolution, I think you're going to see the 4K TVs take off there first. So that was a really a big thing. You saw a lot of tablet PCs, definitely with the hot thing at the show, and various types of what I'll call hybrid designs. The cover comes off of a laptop to become a tablet. Things flip around to become a standing tablet, horizontal or portrait versus landscape. You saw the beginning of the smart watches and wearable technology, but I think you're going to see much more by 2014. But there were a few players there. You saw 1.8 5 million square feet of cool technology from 150 different countries and 20,000 products launched. Kind of amazing.
Then there's that whole other side, those amazing keynotes from outstanding people. Can you talk more about those keynotes and maybe some facts and figures?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the keynotes, and, you know, the keynotes are really looking out to what's around the corner. One of our keynoters was Nolan Bushnell, and he talked about the future of kids and the capacity to learn and change how we learn. One being that kids love to be entertained. And if you remember, Nolan Bushnell was the inventor of Atari and then Chuck E. Cheese. So he's taking these ideas about kids and entertainment and applying them to the classroom, and showed a great demonstration of basically how we could all memorize every bone in the body in about 20 seconds through his game. So you're seeing a lot of gamification from people like that. We had Walt Mossberg and Joel Klein at one of our conferences talking about what's happening in the higher education sector. Joel Klein was the chancellor of schools in New York and then now works for Rupert Murdoch and just announced for a company called Amplify and just announced a tablet PC and learning management system. And Walt talked about the MOOCs, the massively online college curriculum courses that are so prevalent right now, whether they would replace physical colleges as we know them or not. And you're seeing companies like Udacity and Coursera actually taking some of the brightest, best professors in the world and offering them to everybody. It's a major phenomenal change. You're seeing the Panasonics really push the internet entertainment solutions. And interesting to me is some of the keynotes were for some of the automakers, and you're seeing them talk about, A, driverless cars. We had the Google driverless car actually in our exhibit area. It drove from San Francisco to Vegas, navigating with what's called LIDAR, sort of a combination of radar and sensors and all sorts of things. So driverless cars are around the corner, but today you have all sorts of aids to help you park hands-free, to make sure you're not, there's no blind spot anymore because you've got sensors there telling you what to see. So the cars also have come, technology has sort of pervaded everything. And in sports, we had one of the keynoters talked about detecting sports injuries like concussions through monitoring impact of hits to the head and really saving people's lives. We had the Proteus pill, a digestible pill that you swallow and it takes photos on its way down. So you're seeing the world of digital health also just become a part of technology.
Now that's really, really exciting about what occurred at CES this year. I'm even more excited now. What will amaze us in, let's say, in 2014?
Yeah, I know. It's so I think I love to play prediction because I'm usually wrong, but it's so much fun so I'm going to predict what you'll see a lot of, and then you can yell at me afterwards and tell me I was wrong. So I think this idea of gesture, if you know the Xbox from Microsoft, it's great. You don't have to speak. And, you know, eliminating using a mouse for older people, for younger people, for all kinds of people is a great thing because it's a level of abstraction you don't need. So with Xbox, you gesture. You wave, and then you get to play games like punch boxing and kickboxing and dancing. And it actually looks at all of your joints and can map them onto the screen. You're going to see that technology in a bunch of different things. In particular, we're starting to see $99 Android devices that have gesture technology in them. You're starting to see, by this time in 2014, you'll see smartphones with gesture. I have the Samsung Galaxy, and all I do now is just, when I want to take a picture, I hold my camera up and I say smile or cheese, and it takes the picture for me. So I think by next year, you're going to see phones that know it's you when you pick it up, that know to tell you when you've forgotten it, because they have trackers in them that will set off an alarm when you get past a certain number of feet away from your phone. So I think mobile's just going to get better and better. The other thing that you're going to see is big data. So we talk a lot about using apps, and the app collects my data, it monitors my pedometer, you know, how many steps I walked, or how many calories I took in. But when you start to take everybody that uses a device and collect all that data, which has good and bad sides, you start to see a picture of the whole. Where in the country are people not exercising enough? Where are the centers for, you know, potential obesity or diabetes? And you're starting to see the aggregate of our data being used to anticipate everything from where a computer virus will attack next to don't take the freeway. And so the aggregate of our collective lives online is becoming really important.
Well, I just can't wait. And I can't wait to see all of the events that you're going to be hosting and organizing as well. In fact, this year I attended as an investor because I'm involved with several investment groups and accelerators. And then I also attended as part of the media. So just, I don't know, it was just an amazing experience. And I would say you spawned it all.
Well, we have to get you involved in it. And that's, we should figure out a way. So our digital health conference, actually, and Silver Summit, we have investors, you know, sort of judge things, you know, the whole incubator type of thing. So we should see separately from this interview how we can work together. But one other area that is really going to grow, two other areas, actually, genomic research. We're getting to the point where you can actually, we came really close this year to having an exhibit that was going to, on a laptop PC, be able to take your cheek swab and give you a DNA sequencing right there on the show floor. Fell short by a couple of weeks of it being ready, but I think we'll have it next year. That's pretty exciting. One of the most popular things that we showed this year was such a simple idea, but it made so much noise. It was called the Happy Fork. It's a fork-shaped device, but if you eat too quickly, it sends you a little buzz shock to remind you. So that's this idea of sensors and the Internet of Things. And, of course, the next thing that also is going to be huge is robotics. As they get smarter and have more sensors, they're capable of all sorts of things, from being your personal aide to going out somewhere dangerous before you to taking over many of our factories. And, you know, those are some of the issues we're going to grapple with.
Well, Robin, judging sounds like a lot of fun. Count me in.
I definitely will. You can pick mobile apps, Last Gadget, or actually be part of our VC. I'll turn the table. What do you think? Make something work. You know, and we definitely should keep talking. Probably the one other thing that I'm particularly excited about is the maker, and I'm going to give the credit to a fellow named Dale Daugherty, who coined the term the maker movement, and he coined the term for kids. There are two makers fairs now in the United States, one in California and one in New York, where kids, families, everybody just comes and makes stuff. And it's not only is it not embarrassing to know how to use a solder gun or to have a dream about doing something, but it's really cherished and prized. And I think we're seeing, you know, as a culture, we're seeing a lot of pride in making things again and understanding how things work. And I find that terrifically exciting because these kids have to have the skills of 21st century workers, and they're really going to be so very different, and we kind of ignored that for too long.
Robin, you are really the keystone of an entire ecosystem globally, and you're going to see a lot of stuff, and you're going to engage with some of the top thinkers in the world, your peers. And so you're also going to see controversy. Can you share some sort of insights of what you consider to be areas of controversy?
There are so many areas of controversy. Right now the debates, let's take one debate is gamification. The idea that you learn when you're playing a game and you get rewards, and health companies are now using this. Your employee will use this for getting involved in particular your HR and benefits life. And it's really, if you go back to your psychology, you remember B.F. Skinner with the rats in the cage? We're not talking about things that are any different than that. We're talking about being, you hiked your number of steps today, or you kept your calorie limit, you get a reward. And so the interesting thing is, that's personal information. What happens when your employee understands that and says, I see here that you drink 3 drinks a day, you know, and, or you drink a large size soda if you live in New York City. We're not going to hire you. So it's going to get really interesting to see how the information that you voluntarily give up, is going to be, could be potentially used against you. So that's one area. Certainly the other area is internet freedom. I mean, I can ask you what you think Google knows about you, what you think Facebook knows about you, or Twitter. There are actually some interesting algorithms out now to show you. There's a Wolfram, W-O-L-F-R-A-M, Alpha. If you go to Wolfram Alpha and you just type the Facebook report, you will find out more about your behavior than you ever wanted to know if you're a Facebook user. And it's a real eye-opener. So this idea of intentional computing, mindful computing, is going to become really important. And addiction to the second world, your virtual world, is going to be a really big problem. Universal accessibility, that everybody should have this technology. The good news is the costs are coming down. A smartphone is no longer prohibitively expensive, but we have to make it a part of a value system so that every minority wants a smartphone as much as they want a boombox. And that's going to be a cultural shift, and it's happening fast, and it's really great. But if everybody doesn't have equal access, if a shut-in can't get online to enjoy the company of others, then we haven't done a good job. And then there's a whole idea of, I think, where your interests are, of accreditation. You know, the FDA the other day announced that they were going to get involved in the regulation of mobile applications for health. Okay, so is somebody going to accredit you to fix a computer? Is somebody going to right now there are, because things happen so quickly, you could go to college, major in English, and become a programmer. Or, you know, there hasn't been an employment path. You have business cards that say, you know, I'm the chief guru evangelist. We've got names people don't know. So I think accreditation as we know it today is getting a little antediluvian.
Robin, that's a great segue into my next question. And, you know, you have the U.S. government now requiring some sort of accreditation for people who want to work in the security area. With security credentials, or if you're doing auditing, they like some kind of credentialing associated with ISACA, this sort of international global organization. And in fact, the Inspector General of the House of Representatives has full accreditation in that area. So you have all these individuals who are holding different kinds of accreditation for different sectors in the industry. And then I guess this leads to this question, then, do you think computing in general should be a recognized profession on par with, let's say, accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development? In other words, doing professional development every year.
I think so, you know, because I think it changes so quickly. You know, a lawyer goes back to school and has to learn, you know, is Facebook admissible evidence, and the doctor has to go back and recraft as new tools come out and learn about electronic health records. So here you are, you know, in college, you've learned, well, Pascal or C or HTML, and those skills are non-transferable. The question is, are people going to become lifelong learners because they've got to stay in the job force, or because they need a credit to get a job somewhere? And I don't know the answer. I think there's going to be a lot of societal crowd pressure for you to stay ahead of your game. I've been doing this for over 30 years, and if you ask me what keeps me up at night, it's, oh my God, what if I don't know the next thing? I mean, what if my brain just explodes? So I think there's going to be a crowd pressure for you to keep your skills up, in any of these things. And so you're just not going to go to the doctor who doesn't do hip implants from the back, or the guy who doesn't use a 3D printer to make a mold of your teeth. And some of this is going to just be reinforced by the crowd and by reviews. And then that begs the question, for all these accreditation, what can you do? And if you look at the model of universities now in the MOOC space, you can take the courses for free. What you can't do is get the certificate. So I can go to nursing school at the University of Southern California, take every course, but when it comes to get the piece of paper, I got to pay. And the model that we've seen in everything from radio to print to paying for things is going to get tougher to maintain. You're already seeing a society that's balking at paying $50,000 a year for a bricks and mortar college. So it's a real issue that we're going to face. I can't say I have all the answers, but it's going to be interesting. And I think, you know, any accreditation system just really has to stay on top of their game now and make sure that they're asking, the return of that accreditation is equal to the effort people need to put in. So you're really getting something valuable.
And then there's the additional elements associated with being a profession, and that is things like adhering to a code of ethics and a discipline process if you breach it, taking personal responsibility for your work, having public accountability, ensuring that there's quality assurance, and we already talked about this, accreditation, but recognized credentials.
Yeah, it's a really tough one because we're kind of inventing a lot of the rules as we go, and clearly we're going much faster than regulatory bodies. And, I mean, take Google. We all remember what their, you know, initial model was, you know, do no evil. Who knows? it's a big responsibility, I think that part of being in groups like the CEA, two things happen. Best practices come out and are applauded and recognized. So how to handle opt-in data, how to handle children under 13, how to handle security issues. And then I think that, you know, an accredited path is going to be really important. You know, I don't have to tell you, because of social media, our public and our private lives are pretty much the same now. And it's going to be very interesting to see how we become ethical people in a virtual world. And I like to say that the internet is like having a microscope on society. You know, the good and the bad in society just becomes gooder and badder on the internet. And I think that is that's not going to go away. That's human nature. So we just sort of have to, and we push the limits of all sorts of things and pull back. And Mark Zuckerberg is probably the clearest example of somebody who's pushed and pulled internally with his company to try and get the right balance, because it's all uncharted territory. And you know that more and more, whether it's space exploration, whether it's prosthetic engineering, technologists are going to, whether it's end of life, you know, they're talking about doing brain transplants within the next 35 years. That's going to mean that your brain can live on forever if that's what you want. So it's going to become a very much of a cross-disciplinary world where we really need some strong ethicists.
Robin, you have this incredible background, and we talked a little bit about this already. You know, you've got this great editorial background, a great background as an auditor, as an author. You've won numerous prizes for your work in the industry. You are the heart of this, you know, the very famous CES show with your Digital Health Summit, your Silver Summit, the Sports and Fitness Technology, the Higher Ed Tech, Kids at Play Summit, Mummy Tech Summit, Fashion Wear, The Last Gadget Standing, the Mobile App Showdown. You write for Mashable, Forbes, Huffington Post,
you want to know if I sleep.
I mean, it's incredible, you know. You've advised the president or vice president and the first lady Hillary Clinton in the past, and you've sat on National Research Council committees, and it just goes on and on and on, and just simply amazing. Which means, I would say, because of all your speaking and travels and work, you've got to have some great stories to share.
I definitely do. some more embarrassing, some pretty funny. I mean, some where I think I called it exactly right. So I was asked to testify when the COPPA legislation, C-O-P-P-A, to protect children came about, and the idea behind that legislation was it was going to protect parents and their children by requiring parental permission to target or advertise or speak to anybody under 13. And everybody thought it was a great idea. And I said, you know, here's the problem with the idea, that only you had to get parental permission. That's a very expensive proposition. So I said, only the Disneys and MTVs and Nintendos can afford to do that. And the other people will take the easy way out and said, we're not talking to kids. That's it. At the time, I was consulting for the Princeton Review, and their decision was really simple. Okay, no more 13-year-olds on the, under 13 on the site. So I felt like it was a really bad decision that I tried to influence on the record to be changed. I think we're still feeling it now. Nobody even knows what kids like, because if you're adhere to the law, you can't take any information like where did they spend their time on your site, what did they learn, where are they located, can they talk to other friends? So that remains, that's been a disappointment, and I think the more they keep picking at this law, the worse it's going to get. So I actually think it should be a personal decision for your family. We now are educated enough about the Internet. There are tools. There are all sorts of things that you should pick. I have to say the funniest thing that ever happened to me was showing up to give a speech at the White House without my pants. I left New York in the middle of the night because I had theater tickets the night before. I didn't want to miss the theater. I drove through a snowstorm with a crazy nut driver who, when I said I needed to go to Washington, thought he was going to the Washington on the other side of the country. I get to this hotel across from the White House. It is snowing. I've got like 2 hours now that I've caught this guy, and we went back the other way. 2 hours to prepare. I open my suitcase. I've got my black jacket and my white shirt, but I don't have any pants. And I've got to go talk about Internet safety and kids in front of Al Gore. So I went to the kitchen, and I asked everybody in the kitchen, you know, in every language I could think of, did they have black pants they could lend me? Who else would be open to that hour? Nobody. So I finally decided, okay, I'm going to have to just suck it up and put on gym pants, which I had in my bag, and I'm not a 20-year-old. So I put on my gym pants, and I walked into the room, and another journalist took me aside and said, what are you wearing? I said, I left my pants on. She said, quick, come up to my room. What size are you? So I was just saved by the bell before I had to deliver this speech. Another one was I actually flew out to do the last Gadget Standing in a private plane with Martha Stewart. She was coming out to watch me do a last Gadget Standing. So she and my boss. And right before the show, I had the laptop. Somebody asked me to make a change in the PowerPoint, the name of their company, and the laptop slid off my lap and just died. And so there I just flown out in private plane, Martha Stewart, full audience, as you saw, 500 people sitting there, and I can't even think about what I would do without a laptop to control this presentation and all the AV and the notes. So we called the tech guys, and nobody could fix it. And I had a friend with me, and he said, I bet if we swap hard drives, and we're already late, but it was a compact computer, and he ran through the show floor halls, and he sees a guy doing email on the floor with my exact same computer, and he goes, sir, we need that computer now. And he brings it back, and we unscrew the drives, and we switch, and actually everything was fine, and I sent the guy out to dinner and gave him nice flowers afterwards, but saved my life. you know, when you do as many things as I do, you end up in really silly situations. I once actually walked into the wrong Hilton, saw a bunch of people talking about technology, got up on the stage, said, is it my turn now? And just heard all this tittering, people laughing at me. I was at the wrong conference. They were taking a break. I go, why are you taking a break? I'm supposed to talk now. So lots of stuff happens when you sort of live on the edge, but it always works out.
Hey, those are great stories. Probably the best I've heard so far in all the years I've been doing these interviews.
But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I really do, all goes back to my husband. You know, I really want you to be a journalist. I'm sitting there with a typewriter. He just brings home a Unix terminal and said, "This, you're going to love this." I forced me to write this article, How I Learned About Computers to Save Our Marriage, to send it to InfoWorld, a young publication. I don't think they'd ever read anything like it, you know, and I just would write articles the way people would go to therapists. It just made me feel better. Bought that article, and then people just started to call and say, "Can you write more like this? Can you write more like this?" And when PC Magazine first hired me, I will never forget, the first thing was to review printers, and they made me run a test that looked at high-order ASCII sets. And I literally had to call my husband and say, "They want me to look at high-order key sets. What are they talking about?" But little by little, because we all grew up in it together, I really saw my role as an interpreter so that other people didn't have to deal with the pain of ASCII, but they knew if they wanted to type an ampersand that it would be there.
And Robert, I would say you have the equivalent of like 5 PhDs in technology because you've been immersed in it for so long and seen sort of the birth of so many technologies and been intimately sort of writing about them.
Yes, yes, I wish, but you know, sort of like the teacher, it's funny you should say that. I on a bet one day, I took my magazine staff when we reviewed products. I said, "I don't think you should review a product until you can build one and market it. And so I'm going to do this." And so it was the year that it was the Kerry Bush election, and I built waving watches. There wasn't a chip in this watch. It just was a picture of Kerry and a picture of Bush on a watch face with a third hand that waved like the Mao watches from China. So I get an engineer and we get a guy to work with China as a middleman, and who knew that everything that you ordered in that country came from 17 different factories. You know, the watch face came from one place, the leather came from one, you got on shoes. It was really complicated, but when you bought a Carrier or a Bush watch, it registered on my website, the election watch. So it actually did it okay. We brought these watches to the country. We had like 4 SKUs and it nearly killed us. We had to have a manual and boxes and tech support. When people live through that, the respect that they have for a company that can actually get a product to make your life better out on the market is just astounding. There's so many parts to it.
Well, Robin, we're down to our last question, and this is where I sort of turn the tables, and I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Yeah, so I think the question I would ask is, you know, how do we make technology more equal for everybody? And there are lots of answers to it, but I'm going to take the simplest. Our cities are sort of dying because of internet commerce. I mean, people shop online and you see store after store going out of business, and it's kind of sad. So I think there's like a whole new kind of store that you're going to see, 21st century experience, where you can, much like the Maker Faire, you can go in and make things. You can cook dinners there and bring them home. People are going to have to rethink what it means to be bricks and mortar. You can try out technology, like the Apple Store has been a very successful brick and mortar store. So how can you do more like that? Sephora, where you get to put on the makeup. You know, so this idea of active stores, virtual dressing rooms, I think are going to re-liven city life, and so I'm really concerned with that. The other thing I'd ask is, how is technology going to help us? The demographics are changing in this country. Everybody's getting older. It's not a very sexy part of technology, but how can technology help us get through this? So we're seeing a lot of the answers, but we're seeing a lot of things like GPS trackers, where you can draw an electronic fence for the aging person that you're trying to keep tabs on. My own mother wears a cellular pendant, and so she can hit one button. should she fall down. And they've got a complete medical history. They have all of my brothers and sisters' phone numbers. So they've got everything they need. Emergency trained person answers that 10-minute call and gets in touch with one of us or the doctor. You know, they make that call. I think you're going to see smart homes where you walk in and the lights know it's you and authenticate you. They're going to know if you left your stove on, and because there'll be a chip in your internet pot that will, a sensor that will let you know, help you find your keys, help you stay in touch with your family. And all of this will come out to let you age at home with dignity and control and communication. I think that's huge.
Robin, you've taken us on this amazing journey during the discussion here, and I know your schedule is very demanding, so we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, and thank you for sharing your life's experiences and all of the lessons you've learned with our audience.
Thanks so much, Stephen. It's been great, and you're a great interviewer. I'm going to call you whenever I need a compliment.
Robin, again, it was a real pleasure talking with you, and especially with your tremendous background and I just really enjoyed the whole session, so I'm going to close off and just say that I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Robin Raskin, ICT and CES legend and digital pioneer.